This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
From Variety, celebrating 115 years covering the business of entertainment, this is the Award Circuit Podcast. Like many shows, the COVID-19 pandemic forced Rob McElhenney and the producers of Apple TV Plus's Mythic Quest to rethink some of its story plans.
Yeah, it was quite different insofar as we had written the entire second season right before we shut down. So we had to essentially throw all of those scripts out and start over. And we were happy to do it because the world had completely changed in the last year. And we knew that if we were gonna come back and shoot another season of the show, that it would have to at least reflect the realities of where the world is.
I'm Michael Schneider, and on this bonus edition of the Variety Awards Circuit Podcast, we talked to Mythic Quest star and executive producer Rob McElhenney about season two of the comedy and some of the unique choices and experiments it makes with its storytelling. Later on, we chat with TV icon Katie Sagal about her recurring role on The Conners, as well as her recent but alas short-lived ABC drama Rebel. It's all next on Variety's Awards Circuit Podcast. Stay close.
It's more of a feeling than anything else. I'm seeing moss-covered fortresses, cities shimmering with silver and gold. Oh, I'm seeing castles dripping in antiquity.
What does that even mean? Something can't drip in antiquity. The castle's either old or it isn't. You can't...
Like this.
Yes! Yes! That's exactly what I have in my head.
How did you...
God, you guys are absolutely incredible. It's like I just come up with these crazy ideas and then you just whip them up.
Well, producing a full high-quality render would require significantly more time.
Yeah, definitely. So let's get on it.
Are you sure? No notes before we begin?
No, it's perfect. And if it isn't, we'll just fix it later.
Right, but if you give us the notes now, we won't have to fix it later, and we've never nailed it on our first try.
Oh, don't be so modest. You guys got the goods.
It's Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. I'm Michael Schneider, and that was Rob McElhenney as Ian Grimm, the co-creative director of the popular video game Mythic Quest. This season on Mythic Quest, the TV show, that is, Ian and his colleague and fellow creative director Poppy Lee, played by Charlotte Nickdow, are working separately to develop a new expansion of the game, and the pressure's on. Mythic Quest returned for season two on Apple TV Plus in May after two specials that served as bookends of sorts to the pandemic. Last year's quarantine episode, shot completely remotely with iPhones at the cast's homes, has been lauded as one of the best pandemic-related installments of any TV show. And this April, the Everlight episode signified the team's return to the office. I hopped on the Zoom recently with McElhenney to catch up on how the second season of Mythic Quest is going and how the show is focusing more deeply on supporting characters this year and where things are heading as the show heads towards the season finale. We also talk about dropping episodes weekly versus all at once and about the longevity of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. We began by discussing those two pandemic specials and how it wasn't under ideal situations, yet they managed to really make great TV out of it.
Yes, it worked out from a creative standpoint, that aspect worked out well. However, I would give it all up to have never gone through it in the first place. That's for sure. We're really proud of those episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, to have those bonus episodes, at least it's the classic take lemons, turn it into lemonade. And I still think about that episode. That was a year ago now that you guys had already shot that quarantine episode. And at the time you had to do everything at home. You had to use those iPhones. At least we've found new and interesting ways to produce TV in this past year, and you've been at the forefront of that. So when you look back at this year, what do you make of it and the challenges that you faced in getting back into production and figuring out how to do this in the middle of a pandemic?
Well, it certainly wasn't easy. That's for sure. But where there's a will, there's a way, and we recognize that. When we first produced that original episode, truly what we were just trying to do is get everybody back to work for a few weeks, three or 4 weeks, 2 weeks of prep and shooting and post. But we had to do it from our homes, and so we weren't doing anything else except homeschooling our children at the time. So we thought, well, let's just put our heads together and try to figure this out, which is how and why we shot that original quarantine episode. And then sure, from a practical standpoint, it was just about getting the right equipment and learning how to utilize it correctly and then execute upon it. But then, from a story perspective, it was all just sort of unfolding before our eyes. I mean, there were certainly comical aspects for all of us to be communicating on things like this, Zoom. And then there was also the pathos of true self-isolation. Those are the things that a lot of people were having to deal with and are still continuing to have to deal with, unfortunately. And so we wanted to encapsulate all of that and tell that story. And it was just out of necessity. We didn't have any other means or any other way to do it, except for that. And so we embraced it.
Yeah. It also, I mean, it felt like a turning point for the show as well, in terms of, it was possibly the most emotional episode that you guys have done. And how did that sort of inform doing that bonus episode, inform when you guys started sitting down and planning out season two? Was it a different season two than you were expecting, or how did all of that sort of inform getting back to the story and these relationships?
Yeah, it was quite different insofar as we had written the entire second season right before we shut down. So we had to essentially throw all of those scripts out and start over. And we were happy to do it because the world had completely changed in the last year. And we knew that if we were going to come back and shoot another season of the show, that it would have to at least reflect the realities of where the world is right now and where it was according to the narrative as it picks up in season two. So that's why we felt like, when we jumped into season two, we wanted to put the pandemic behind us. We knew that we would be airing during a time when the world was hopefully transitioning out and that we wouldn't be past it. But at the same time, that we felt the people would be kind of sick of talking about it and living in the experience, and they would want to look in their rearview mirror at COVID. So that's how we approached season two. But we also wanted to make sure that we were being respectful of what that transition was going to be like and how it was going to be very difficult, both practically and emotionally, for people to go back and return to a sense of quote unquote normalcy. And so that's why we made the Everlight episode and released that a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. So to talk about when the idea came about to do Everlight as sort of a palate cleanser, as sort of a transitional episode to, I mean, it is a celebration. It's sort of what I think we're all hoping to do in the coming months. Maybe with not the same kind of budget to create an entire universe the way you guys did in that office, but it was a nice sort of transitional moment for you guys.
Yeah, I mean, it was important to us to make sure that as we were leaning into season two, that we wanted to have the show feel like a very relatable workplace comedy, because that's what we believe that it is. The fact that they make a video game, I don't want to say it's irrelevant. It's obviously important to the story, but it certainly takes a backseat to the interpersonal dynamics of the characters that just happen to be stuck together at work. Something that everybody or a lot of people in the world can relate to. But when we were talking about making this transition back in, we said, well, that's all well and good, but how can we take full advantage of all the resources that we have to tell a really big and fantastical story that will ultimately not only help us transition into the second season, but will just give us a really fun and optimistic view of the present and hopefully the near future.
And it also sort of, it sets up the fact that you were focusing even more on these characters this season. So Poppy and Ian obviously are at the center still. And we see early on how they're adjusting to this new partnership and Ian seems to be doing okay with it. Poppy is also feeling okay. And that sort of allowed you also to really start to focus on the testers and with Brad and CW and some of the other characters. So kind of talk about that and wanting to dive deeper into who these folks are this season.
Yeah, it was really important to us that if you're going to make an office comedy, that you make sure that all of the characters are really well-rounded and three-dimensional characters. And you know, one of the benefits of the new era of television for us, from a creative standpoint, is that we don't have to do 22 or 24 episodes of a show each year. We do about 10. However, that allows us to keep things fresh and to pursue other things and to make sure that each episode is really solid. However, one of the drawbacks of that is that it doesn't allow for the audience to develop a long-term relationship with characters, which then allows you to take them to more emotional places, or at least allows you to understand them a little bit better. So what we wanted to do was make sure that in the second season, right off the bat, we started getting into the personal lives of some of the characters who would be considered supporting characters. Characters like, for example, the testers, they were essentially relegated to one very simple and not very complex storyline, which was, are they or aren't they going to get together and fall in love? And we knew very early on, like, I just wanted to dispense with that immediately. In the very first episode of season two, we end that story. At least we put a bow on that story, and then we move on very quickly from there to what really makes these people tick. What do they actually want? Now that they have each other, and the audience has seen that, great. Now you're 23 years old. What do you want to do with the rest of your life? These are the questions that we were asking the young writers in the room. Tell us about that experience. Tell us about what it's like to be in love, but also have all these passions and things that you want to pursue with your life, and that constant push-pull. Once you start opening up those lines of communication in the writer's room, then anything can happen.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see like how you guys decided to also switch around the character dynamics. You know, I'm thinking especially David, the saddest sack of all sad sacks on this show. And you see, you know, him also sort of going through his evolution, sharing more about his busted marriage, he's a sad character. And then on top of it all, you take Joe away and you put her with someone else. And so you kind of have to break down this character, reinvent this character. And again, with only a limited amount of time. Was there any specific character that you're really wanted to focus on this season, or were really excited to kind of explore who they were and what they were up to?
Well, certainly Murray's character, C.W. Longbottom, because he's played for almost the entirety of the first season. And then for the first few episodes of the second season, he's played as essentially one dimensional. He comes into every scene. He kills every time he walks on because he's so funny. Murray's so funny. The character's so funny. But he is certainly a fish out of water. What makes him so funny is that he does not belong there for so many different reasons. In many ways, he becomes, I wouldn't want to say reprehensible because he's not, but some of his behavior does not, and some of the things he says do not belong in the modern workplace. And so we felt like, yes, that's funny to a certain extent, but eventually not only is that going to get old, it's also going to get irresponsible because you just have somebody come in and echo common ideas, maybe from the 60s and 70s and 80s of what a workplace should be. At a certain point, it's just going to get old, and at best and at worst, people are going to start to turn on him because they're going to start wondering why he's not figured this out already, that he can't act a certain way in the workplace. And so what we wanted to do was, you know, we wanted to tell his backstory, and we wanted to get into a little bit of what his life was like before he came to MythicQuest, not necessarily from a comedic perspective, but from a dramatic perspective, which is why we made a flashback episode to him in the 70s. And I think that is starting to paint a more vivid picture of who that character is. And then it allows for you to enjoy him even more in the present.
I do love that you guys, this is sort of, I don't know if this is a permanent hallmark of Mythic Quest, but the fact that you're willing to play with the form and do a flashback and do sort of a non-typical episode during the season run, just like you did in season one. Talk about sort of like having fun with the form and you know, sort of challenging yourself to do something different with some of these episodes.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because we sit in the writer's room and we say, look, we recognize that we want to make the show as relatable to as many people as possible. You know, I have this other show that we do the opposite. Sunny, we've made for 15 years, and our whole thing is, how can we make this as niche as possible? How can we get it so that it's upsetting so many people because we're holding a mirror up to the culture and it becomes unsettling, and to the point where people are just, they're repulsed by it in some ways and they don't want to watch it anymore because it's too, either hits too close to home or it just isn't their cup of tea. Whereas this kind of show, we don't want to do that. We actually want to attract more people and say, hey, these are people just like you. This is a workplace just like your place of business that you go to work every day. However, as we're sitting there and saying, great, we could do 10 episodes of just like your average ho-hum day at the office. You come to work and you're navigating all the same things that everybody has to deal with. And then we go, great, we just broke 3 episodes like that. And those are super fun and fantastic. But how can we do something completely different? And I think that's just a function of where we are right now as an audience. I know that when I sit down to watch a show, I don't want it to be the same thing week after week after week. I appreciate the shows take risks and take you to places that you didn't expect to go. And I'm inspired by that. I'm inspired by it when I see it in other shows. And so I want to reflect that in ours.
Yeah. Well, especially because of just how people now watch shows. I know, you know, you guys are released on somewhat of a weekly basis, but a lot of folks wait and they binge them all at once. And so it's in some ways it gives you a little more latitude to be able to do something like that.
Well, you know, it's funny because Michael, like it's really interesting. Like one of the criticisms that I heard of the show, which then wound up becoming a compliment, was fascinating to me. So last year we dropped, as a lot of the streamers are want to do at this point, dropped all of the episodes at once. And we thought, oh, great, like people will binge it. And it turned out that they did. And a lot of the criticism that I saw was like, was people saying like, you know, I don't, at first I didn't really like the characters because I didn't know them that well. But then like, as I continued to watch the show, I really started to like them a lot more. And then I thought, oh, they were really funny. And I was like a television show? I mean, that's what a TV show is, right? I mean, it just used to be that you would watch an episode. The pilot was always the trickiest one because you didn't know who the people were. You were just dropped right in. Very rarely on any of the shows that I've ever loved did you jump right into the pilot and go, I get it. I love everybody here like they're my best friend and I can't wait to see them again next week. No, it took a little time. It took a little effort. It took a little a little bit of it just seeping into your consciousness. So if you just watch 3 in a row, sure, you're probably not going to, by the third episode, it's still not going to have seeped into your consciousness who these people are, what they want, what are the backgrounds, where they're coming from. You're not absorbing it in the way that it was meant to be absorbed. And so I really like the idea of us dropping an episode, waiting, you know, you wait until next week and you can't wait to see it again. Yes, of course. You know, when you're watching Game of Thrones and you're like, damn it, I wish I had the next episode right now. And yes, it's a little bit frustrating going to bed, but in the same way that, you know, you want that second piece of cake, but if you just had all the pieces of cake, you would eat them all before you went to bed, then you'd be sick.
Yeah.
Well, right. Like, so yeah.
The bottom line is people love to complain. So if a show is sort of dropped all at once, no, just give it to me every other week. And then when shows are drip and drab every other week, why can't I binge this all at once?
As everybody sort of echoes at one point or another during these kinds of conversations, like I do miss that time where there was a certain amount of opportunity for chatter amongst people, like coming into a writer's room and saying, hey, did you see that thing last night? Did we all have that shared common experience of that episode of fill in the blank? And you know, that's just gone now. And it's hard to have a common experience if we can't talk about anything because you've seen every episode and she's only seen one and he hasn't seen any. And now don't spoil it for me. And then I don't know when we're supposed to talk about it. 3 years from now when everybody's all caught up.
Right.
And that I do believe that that's taking away from the experience of a shared communal experience of television.
Yeah. No, I think it's true. There was something when Lost was on, especially you could not wait until Thursday, and that sort of that anticipation all day, that excitement that you knew that episode was coming, you had no idea what was going on. I do kind of miss that. Really miss that. So, yeah. So you mentioned, it's so funny when you talk about Sonny and how, you know, it's a mirror of some of the just the awful aspects of humanity and the idea of repulsing viewers when this is a show that you guys just signed a new deal. You're going to go for 18 seasons, longest running, you know, live action comedy in history, which is insane. Do you think that's ever going to happen again? Will there ever be a show that even goes over 100 episodes? TV has changed so much, even since you guys started Sunny back in the day.
I don't know for sure, but whenever you say never, that's never going to be 100% accurate. I also will say that for any time I ever want to get high up on my horse, all I have to do is walk into my living room. And like last night, I'm not exaggerating. Last night and for the last week, I hear this laughter going on in the living room, and it's my children. And then I hear this like canned laughter, and I'm like, oh, they're watching a sitcom. And I walk in and they're watching America's Funniest Home Videos. And I look to see it, and they're watching season 31, episode 6 or something like that. And they just can't get enough of it. And if they turn that off, then they watch The Simpsons season 28, you know, episode 4. So I don't know. I think when something works and people are still willing to continue to make it, I think it can continue on, and they can, you know, I watched a few episodes of The Simpsons this year from this season, and I haven't seen an episode of The Simpsons in 10 years, but I watched it with them and it worked.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It was hilarious. It's still fresh. They're still making really original, fun, cool television. So, you know, from their perspective, why would you ever stop?
Yeah, that's true. Well, what keeps you guys going on Sunny? What inspires you guys to keep going?
The world just keeps giving us pearls.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what we try to do on Sunny is to satirize current Western culture. And there's just a lot to satirize. I mean, it's still fun for us. It's still working with the people we love spending time with. There's still a massive audience out there. And what's bizarre is that our key demographic has never changed in 14 years. Men and women equally, 50-50, 18 to 35. That's our audience. And so we either get a new crop of people turning 18 and aging into it, or turning 36 and aging out of it. And so that has been going on every year, year after year, for the last 15 years. And so we are now at the point where people were 3 years old when Sunny premiered, and they're now just seeing it for the first time. So, and those are the people that reach out to me, or the people I see on the street, or the people that talk to me on Twitter or Instagram or whatever the social media outlets are, and tell me how much they love it and how their parents used to watch it and wouldn't let them watch it. And so I feel like if that audience is still there, I'm still willing to make it.
Yeah. Well, and like you said, there's always going to be material. The world's not going to change to that degree. So you could conceivably do Sunny forever. Every couple of years, revisit it.
My idol once told me at an event, I walked up to Larry David and we chatted a little bit, and he said to me, "Don't ever stop." I said, "What?" He said, "Never do a last episode ever. Don't ever stop doing it. Just keep doing it." And you realize, like, that's what he's doing with Curb. He's not stopping. He might take off for 4 years and then he'll come back and do another season, but there'll never be a final episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. He learned his lesson from Seinfeld, and it's because people don't want shows to end, because even if they want them to stop, they don't want to have a finality to it, because you want to believe that those people are still existing in that world, doing that thing that they've already done and that they've always done. So I don't know, maybe I'll take his advice, maybe I won't, but for now, we're definitely going to do 18 seasons.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Why ever stop? You know, you don't need to necessarily ever say it's a finale. And by the way, the way the world works right now, you would be rebooting 2 years anyway. So yeah. you'd be.
That would actually be incredible. Like, to see a new crop of people take on the tone of Sunny and see what their version of it would be. You know, like if we gave it to a bunch of, well, that's an interesting experiment. What if you reached out to a group of 25-year-olds, which is how old we were when we did Sunny, and said, okay, make this show, but in the same tone as Sunny? What would their version be? What would their version of satire of a sitcom be in 2021?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
That'd be interesting. You guys have talked about spinoffs, right? What's sort of the feeling on spinoffs?
Not really. I mean, I mean, I love a good spinoff, but I just don't see how this show. I mean, this show, Sunny doesn't live in reality, so the idea of like, you know, some of the greatest spinoffs. I mean, anything off of a Norman Lear show, for example. You know, you could believe that those people really existed outside the sphere of All in the Family, and so you recognize how and why they would you would continue to tell their stories, or you know, Cheers to Frasier. Frasier felt like a real human being, so you recognize how and why he might have a life outside of Cheers. The Sunny characters are, I mean, if there was any kind of spinoff, it would be a cartoon. I mean, it would be an animated series, and that might make some kind of sense.
Yeah. Well, there you go. We've come up with a couple different ideas right here.
How about
a series where you and Caitlin just go around and rescue dogs?
That would be something that she would very much be interested in, that's for sure. And as long as they, yeah, I mean, that was such a happy ending for that dog. But I'll tell you, it was a roller coaster. It was an emotional roller coaster because we truly thought we had this new dog, and the kids took to him, and we took to him, and then, of course, once we found out that he had a family, we returned him. But it was really gratifying. I mean, she definitely saved that dog's life.
It's funny when I Google you right now, it's a mix of you saving dogs and then also you talking about how only guys want to talk about how ripped you are right now.
Because whenever I talk about any kind of body transformation that I've done for the show, I mean, 9 times out of 10, it's a guy. And it's never like, and when we talk about, like when I was in really good shape, like for example, my wife hated it. Caitlin hated it. Because a lot of people say like, oh, that's traditionally an attractive look on a man. And she was just like, you look so sad to me. You look like you're trying too hard, which I was. And you look like you're denying yourself enjoyment, which I was. And that all you're doing is thinking about working out and what your diet is. And that was true. She's like, there's nothing sadder than that. And so it's not attractive. And she's dead right.
So you found a happier medium now.
I found a happy medium.
That's good. That's good. So as we get out of all of this madness, you starting to feel like the world is coming back to normal? Are you getting out more? Are you excited to sort of return to some sort of normalcy? What's sort of your feeling as we head into the rest of this year?
Of course. I mean, I just like the rest of the world really want to return. I mean, I hope that we return with a little bit more respect for each other and our health, and recognize how tenuous this all is, and to recognize that we are truly all in it together. Never is it more clear and obvious that each one of us is an important part of this society. And if we don't all do our part, then we're going to wind up in similar circumstances, just possibly in other areas of potential human crises. So I'm hoping that we recognize that and we all come back and we're stronger and happier and healthier for it.
So how's season 3 looking?
A Mythic Quest? Oh, I don't know. I guess we'll see. I mean, we love making the show, I see a life for this show moving on and on and on and on and on. But we'll see. I think the way that we ended the show this year is really interesting and exciting and scary. And I don't think anything's worth doing unless you're challenging yourself and doing new things. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no spoilers, but have you guys sort of mapped out any sort of future for the show yet? Or are you kind of waiting to see what's next?
No, I learned a long time ago that you can't worry about the next season until you're there on the first day of the writer's room for that particular season. And it's only because if I didn't, I would go crazy. You know, oh, look, you're a writer, so you get it, which is that, you know, as an actor, the second somebody says action, you're working. And when they say cut, you're not working anymore. And when you go home, you might be reliving it a little bit, but you're no longer working. right? You can compartmentalize and you can think about whatever the rest of your day is. Directing, same thing. Producing even, but writing, if you don't figure out a way to compartmentalize and to stop thinking about what you're supposed to be writing or could be writing or should be writing, you will drive yourself insane because you can't escape your own brain. You're always potentially working. At 2 a.m., when you wake up and you think of something, you're working. And that's a dangerous place to be. And I know, I see people. I used to be one of these people that just couldn't stop. I was always concerning myself with what the next thing was going to be. And it just did not bring me joy, that's for sure.
Well, it sounds like you're in a pretty good place right now, Rob. So get back to work on Sunny. We're waiting for those new episodes. So
will do. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That's Rob McElhinney, star and executive producer of Apple TV Plus's Mythic Quest. After the break, Katie Segal does it all. From Los Angeles, this is Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. And we're back. It's the Award Circuit Podcast. I'm Michael Schneider. Inspired by the life of Aaron Brockovich today, ABC's Rebel starred Katie Segal as Annie Rebel Bello, a blue-collar legal advocate without a law degree. She cares desperately about the causes she fights for and the people she loves. Segal also recurs on ABC's The Conners as Dan's love interest and now fiancé, Louise. I spoke to Katie Segal prior to the news that ABC wouldn't be moving forward with a second season of Rebel, but nonetheless, we discussed about what drew her to the project, what she thinks of Aaron Brockovich, and how Segal has been such a badass on camera in recent years. And yes, I also ask why there still hasn't been a Married with Children reboot. But we began by pointing out that Segal was calling into our Zoom from her car.
Well, not hiding. I actually went to one of my first exercise classes back again, and I limped back to my car. So I'm sort of sitting here, you know, before I drive. So that's what's why I'm in my car, sort of hiding, yes.
Yeah. Well, some of the best acoustics, like the past year, what I've needed to do, like serious interviews, like you run to the car, also so that there's no dogs barking or kids screaming at me. It's the car is sort of a safe space. So
it kind of is, yes. Especially us in Los Angeles, the car is the safe space.
Yeah, yeah. So how are you faring during all this as we're sort of like getting out of this pandemic quarantine world? CDC just said today we don't have to wear masks anymore. We're kind of getting back. How are you doing? How are you faring?
I'm feeling so relieved and great about it all. And, you know, I had my children over for Mother's Day, and not that I haven't seen them, but everybody fully vaccinated and big hugs. And I mean, it's fantastic. That is fantastic. I'm waiting for our work environment to, I don't know what the Disney protocol is going to be in terms of loosening. That is still really like the safest place you can possibly be because everybody's masked and shielded and all that. So I'm looking forward to the fall and possibly losing some of that. But it just feels like so much progress has been made, and I'm encouraged, and I encourage everybody to get vaccinated.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, what was the experience like in sort of, when did you produce Rebel? When did you film that?
Well, it was the longest first episode of television ever made. We were supposed to start March, the Monday, and then we got shut down on Friday, March 2020. So that all got postponed. We came back in December. We got about 4 days in, and then somebody in the crew came up positive. So we shut down for 2 weeks, and then it was the holidays. And so we continued to be shut down. And then I think we came back mid-January and finished. I want to say there was one more little bump, but I'm not 100% sure of that. But we finished around mid-February, just the first episode. So it was a very long episode.
So that's got to be, I mean, it's been tough for everyone to produce in this environment, but I imagine launching a new show and sort of, you know, getting the rhythm and getting the vibe and sort of just like getting into it, especially because of all these delays, that must have been a little difficult.
Oh, yeah. I would say it. I mean, it's difficult, and I'm super proud of us and super proud of our crew. And it's kind of amazing that we've been able to do what we've done so far. But yeah, for me as an actor, I have been living with this script for like a year. You know what I mean? So it was so, I was just like raring to go. And it was challenging, I would say, to keep it fresh for me once we finally got up and running, because I had lived with it for so long. So that was challenging. The entire, you know, it's just been an extraordinary process, and I'm amazed that the entertainment business is doing what it's doing. And yeah, and Rebel definitely, you know, what's weird as an actor is you can't really see your fellow actor till they say roll 'em, and you've been rehearsing with a mask, and there's a good and a bad to that. It brings an instant freshness because suddenly you realize, oh, there's a whole other world going on in that other person's face. So there's kind of a newness to it. And then there's also, it's difficult to really get those relationships going. You know, it's taken a little bit longer.
Yeah. Well, and starting in that first episode, there's some physicality involved as well. And I imagine that's tough in general, but again, in these circumstances, there's added level of precaution that comes with it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then the amount of extras you can have, the amount of, you know, and it takes longer, you know, it takes longer and they want you to do it in less time. So it's kind of like, well, so I'm really looking forward to when we can get, you know, we can see each other more. That would be really nice. I don't even know what most of the people on my crew look like, which is really strange, you know, because I'm so used to being with crew and becoming friendly, and you know, you just know everybody. But yeah, every once in a while, I'll see someone without their mask. I'm like, oh, you look completely different than what I thought you would look like.
It's like the Zoom thing. It's like everyone's much taller or shorter than you expect, but no one knows what each other looks like now that it's all via Zoom.
100%.
So I know this seems to come up a lot these days, especially when you've been doing interviews about Rebel, but the whole narrative of Katie Seagal badass and the fact that like you are now so identified with playing so many different badass characters and you know, both, you know, sort of tough and not so pleasant characters, and then characters who are really trying to make a difference, like Rebel and sort of badass for good. But when you kind of look at your career and some of the jobs you've done in recent years, you know, it's sort of, you know, how did you end up here at the badass stage of your career?
Well, I will say, I don't consider Peg Bundy a badass. I wouldn't.
Dude, she was a badass.
Put her in the badass character. Do you think she was a badass? Well, she did put up with him.
She
so
did.
That was pretty badass.
She did. That was pretty badass. Yeah.
I thought she was very sort of positive and just definitely on the bright side as opposed to his dark side. So yeah. I guess in those ways, I feel like the cartoon character I played, Lilo, which is she's also a badass, but she was a badass out of like feeling so separate from just so odd and different. She just got mad. So she was that kind of badass. I feel like they're all different. And why have I ended up here? I never really know why. I have been told many times that I have a formidable presence. So I don't know that definitely must contribute to it. I suppose my kids don't really consider me a badass. So I don't think there's a super badass part of me in life. I mean, I'm definitely a survivor in my life. And so I've been through stuff, and that gives you a sort of an internal fight. It's been great to find the different badass qualities in each of these characters though. They really do have, you know, there's a big difference between playing a biker outlaw, a criminal basically, and then playing Rebel, who is a person that empowers people and is very loud and somewhat obnoxious about it. And her badass qualities are on the side of righteousness, you know? So I kind of really don't know the answer to that question. It just sort of seems to be where I am. I'm not very demure.
Well, talk a little bit about Erin Brockovich and sort of getting to, how much did you get to know her? What's sort of your relationship with her now? And how much of her did you sort of glean in creating this character?
Well, I didn't spend a lot. I haven't spent a lot of time with her. But the time I have spent was one of those like instant connections. You know, you meet somebody and you feel like, oh yeah, I know who this person is. I wasn't surprised when they asked me to play her. It was a good choice. And she, when you sit down with her, we had our first lunch before I said yes to the project. It ended up into a 3-hour girl conversation, basically, three strong women. And we were just talking about stuff. And once Erin gets onto something, she is extremely passionate and not afraid to speak her mind. So I definitely gleaned that. At one point in the conversation, I tried to get into the history of her and then was quickly told that this wasn't her life story. So it's kind of loosely inspired by, and so I'm not playing her. So I kind of made up my own history of Rebel, which is sort of the way I like to work, which is to find out, you know, where I'm from. And so I have my own little fictionalized version. And I don't believe it is true to who Erin Brockovich is, but her energy is what I picked up on. You know, some of her wardrobe is what we went with. You know, she's really an amazing person, and not performative at all in her approach to what she does, and not ego-driven in her approach to what she does. She's not doing it for self-gratification so much as, I mean, self-aggrandizing as so much as I believe she does what she does because she's just incensed by stuff that's not correct. And people, you know, it's been, particularly in this year of people telling us we're not seeing what we're seeing, she's a person that refuses to get off point and, you know, reminds us that, yes, you are seeing what you're seeing.
Yeah. And that's and so you see that in Rebel in that sometimes, you know, she just and I think we can all feel it, like, why don't people see this? Like, why, like, what, like, and that frustration and realizing that not everyone sees that. And sometimes Rebel sort of goes too far and alienates the loved ones around her as she's doing that. But she has this sort of, you know, tunnel vision of, no, we need to, like, we need to expose what's right and what's wrong.
Right.
So I'm just curious, like, as you sort of played, you know, started to get to know this character more and started to sort of figure out who this character was, you know, sort of talk about figuring out who Rebel is.
You know, I did a lot of, well, first of all, I did research on the medical device system in our country. I watched a great documentary called The Bleeding Edge, which talks about basically, medical devices being grandfathered into the system without being tested on humans. And so that's the overriding arc of this season. So I did research into that. I was completely incensed by it. And as we say in one episode, if you're going to get your hip replaced, use an old style hip. Don't get the new ones because they're not as tested as well. So I did that. The family part of her, which is really super interesting to me, you know, because I too am a working mom. Rebel's a working mom with 3 kids. And, you know, 2 out of the 3 are completely resentful that she neglected them so much while she was out fighting the good fight. Ironically, they both go into service work. You know, they're mad at her, but yet one's a doctor and one's a lawyer for pro bono cases. So, and that was very interesting for me to play. And that's kind of not close to home, but I've always felt as a working mom that I couldn't give 100% to wherever I was. It's the struggle of doing what you love and also raising a family. So that was that has been very interesting for me to explore and to, because Rebel, as opposed to Katie, is me. You know, she, it's not that she doesn't care that they're mad at her. It's not her priority that they're mad at her. She really believes in what she's doing. And gee, I'm really sorry that, you know, I wasn't there at the school function, but this was more important. That's where she goes.
Yes.
And yes, I think I'm answering your question. Yeah.
No, that's exactly it. Is you know, it's you can't hate Rebel for, you know, doing it, and her kids don't hate her. They're just and obviously they were inspired by her, even if they can't admit it. But it's yeah, not, there are no perfect scenarios.
No, and there's repercussions, and I'm hoping in our season two we can explore more of that, the sort of repercussions of grown kids that are having to work through, you know, intimacy issues because mom wasn't around and there was no dad and, you know, all those fascinating things that people have to figure out, you know, in their adult lives that are repercussions of growing up a certain way. And yes, Rebel, she's not big on saying, I'm sorry. She's not big on, you know, I mean, she'll definitely admit it if she's gotten something wrong, but she never really thinks she's gotten it wrong. That's a very different quality than I have. So yeah. I've had to kind of go against my instinct about it.
So let's talk about doing double duty at ABC this year. You're big part of that network these days. Take me back to the Connors and what that experience has been like in, you know, getting back in front of multi-camera comedy and working with this cast.
Well, that was a super big gift, I would say. At first, I was just a little bit trepidatious when they called and they said, we're interested in you to play John's or Dan Connor's new love interest. And I knew the whole Roseanne of it all. And I just... you know, I wanted it to be made clear that, and they were very clear about it as well, that we weren't trying to fill in a space that couldn't be filled. So, you know, it was to be a whole new thing. And I feel really, I've done three seasons of it now. And I think they really, I mean, I think the first season I was only in it at the end. And I think they've gradually built this relationship in a very real way. So, first of all, I am unbelievably thrilled to work with John Goodman and Laurie Metcalf and Sarah and Lisi. They're all great actors. It is a super great set over there, wonderfully supportive and funny, you know? So I want to say that we didn't do it in front of a live audience this whole last season, which was fine with me. That was fine. You know, I can do it either way. And, no, it's been great. And I hope to go back. I mean, I really feel like before I took Rebel, I was like, you guys, it's in my contract that I can do both shows because yeah. I really want to stay in that Connors universe if they'll have me. And it seems like the relationship is growing more and more. So,
yeah,
it's fun.
Yeah. Well, they gave Louise COVID so she could go off and shoot Rebel. So,
yes. Yeah, but you'll see. I don't even know if it's, but I get better. Yeah. Louise gets better. She comes back. So, yeah.
So that,
I did that.
That's good. That's good. But yeah, I mean obviously Connors, you know, being the successor of Roseanne, a show that always sort of dealt with real life and things that are going on in the world. You know, it was interesting to see how Connors this season dealt with COVID and bringing that into the conversation and into the storyline and sort of reflecting what everyone was going through in real life.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect forum for that show.
So what do you make of Louise now that she's sort of, you know, slowly become a part of that family as well? And where do you hope things go with that character and with the Connors?
Well, I think what's interesting about Louise, which is interesting about all the parts of Leigh, is that she's flawed. She's not coming in as the, you know, I think she thinks that the rest of them are a little bit nuts, but I think she's got her own little nuts going on. You know, I think that she has spent, you know, 30 years of her life on the road and avoiding any kind of intimate relationships. That's my backstory and my thought on Louise. I think that her falling for Dan Connor is kind of her making a decision to change her life, to be different, you know, to settle in. You know, it's interesting, people that don't want to stop moving around, there's a reason they don't want to stop moving around. And they find that out when they finally slow down. So I think that'll be interesting if they take her in that direction. You know, I don't want to give away what happens in the end of this season, but things are moving forward. So
they've teased proposals, so we can kind of guess where maybe what some of those proposals are. Yeah.
Yeah, they tease all that, and I'll just say it's all positive. So I'm not sure, you know, there's such a good bunch of writers over there. They're just they're great. And so wherever they take it, it's kind of nice to be surprised.
This year with Candace Bergen guest starring too, I mean, I'm loving that it's sort of this mashup of my late 1980s TV viewing.
Yeah, it was really fun. I got to meet her, and, you know, I don't know her, but I worked one day and she was there with her dog, which was really kind of nice. And it's a great casting over there. Super great.
Yeah. Why haven't we had the Married with Children reboot? What's going on? What's taking so long? Every other show has come back.
I know. Well, if you kind of think about it, the Bundys would go against the grain. The Bundys, you know, they would be the last, if ever, to have a reboot. And the truth is, it comes up like every year. It comes up, and either Ed's working, Chrissy's working, and then the biggest hurdle seems to have been getting the rights from the creator. You know, that seems to be the last. I know David Faustino had a pitch for a sort of a Bud Bundy show, which I thought would be great. And then Ed and Chrissy and I were all committed to doing at least the pilot. And then for some reason it went away. I think it has to do with behind the scenes, who is the creator. You know, the original, one of the original creators sadly passed on. And so there's some kind of minutia about that, but it is talked about. It's definitely talked about.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, there's a million streamers out there now. So eventually
I know.
You're going to figure out how to do it.
It'd be so fun. I would love it.
That's Katie Sagal. You can catch up on Rebel and the Connors on Hulu. And that's it for this bonus edition of Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. Drew Griffith edited this episode and Michael Schneider is the producer. Be sure to subscribe to the Award Circuit Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com and click on the Award Circuit tab to find the latest Emmy predictions and key races, as well as your daily fix of news, analysis, and reviews. For Danielle Terciano and Jazz Tanke, I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you on the circuit.